From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott.
That's the alarm.
A drug overdose.
That the oxygen level's low.
But what if the person isn't taken to a hospital quickly enough?
It was traumatic seeing my daughter lying on the ground, unresponsive.
There is an easy-to-administer antidote.
This is Narcan. Two doses of Narcan that I carry in my patrol vehicle.
It works quickly.
Watch, it's going to be like a mummy. And they were dead, weren't breathing. They administered and they sat straight up and asked where they were.
On today's show, how Narcan works and who's allowed to carry it. Also, 29 million Americans have diabetes. How do they manage their illness at work? And a look at biochar. It's not for your grill. First, the news.
Take a test strip out, you insert it in the glucometer, you puncture your finger, you put the blood on the test strip.
Managing diabetes takes time and effort. So how do you do that at work? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
If we find them, we probably have a good idea that an area is healthy.
That's the bean screaming for its life.
Basically, you're allowing air to bubble through.
There are things that you do that influence your friends' friends.
You can't have people making claims and selling tests that have not proven they work yet.
2 to 3 million people in the United States known to be living with epilepsy.
I think it's fantastic. Itchy eyes, sneezing.
No, when upwelling happens, it's when you have these really
different
nice
shakers.
Yes, she can go home.
Everything should be patient-centric.
On today's show, burnt biotrash turns to gold, a disorder leads to new opportunities, and animals become people. Well, sort of. But first up, several weeks ago, the government adjusted its estimate on Americans with diabetes. The number went up again to 29 million people. That also means more people coping with diabetes at work and more workplaces managing people with diabetes. How's all that working out? Tanya English reports.
We all know someone with diabetes, and the count has soared so high, it's easy to ignore the latest alarming statistic.
If you add in what the federal budget has in for education, housing, and energy, it is still less than what we spend every year on diabetes.
Christina Stashuk is a medical director with the insurance company Cigna.
One of the things that we work with is to help employers understand how big diabetes is.
She says complications from uncontrolled diabetes are what really drive up costs. Blindness, amputations, foot trouble.
Strokes, heart attacks, kidney failure.
Insurance companies and large employers like to talk about the programs and the classes and the coaching that they've set up to promote worker well-being.
The way that our employers are approaching it is less disease-specific and more health-focused.
It's harder to get companies to talk about how exactly they handle it when someone with diabetes needs to inject insulin on the job or when a worker wants to take an extra snack break. Stashuk says at that point, it's a question for human resources.
If you need accommodations on the job, your boss has to know because your boss needs to be able to adjust your work schedule to be able to manage your diabetes.
Intihab Ahmed is an endocrinologist at Jefferson University Hospital. He says if you're supposed to inject insulin 2 or 3 times a day, that's not a task that you can forget at home when you head off to work in the morning.
Medicines only work if you take them. It depends on the patient. If they're taking care properly, they should be just like anybody who does not have diabetes.
Diabetes is a disease that needs to be monitored closely. But Ahmed says he gets it. Being that person at work who has to prick his finger to check blood sugar can come with stigma.
I always give this example to my patients that they should see their blood sugar. It's like a termite. It's eating the house, but you don't see any destruction, and then suddenly the house collapses.
A big dip in blood sugar can be a big safety concern, depending on what kind of job you have.
So if you're worried about your patients who are roofers or truckers, do you understand that hesitancy from employers who say, maybe that's someone I don't want to hire?
Yes. You have to take extra steps, extra measures for that particular person. I can see when you're running a business, when you're dealing with numbers, what would you do?
Some companies use diabetes as a reason not to hire.
Well, unfortunately, it happens all the time. It often, though, is in violation of a number of laws, including the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Attorney Gregory Paul is a legal advocate for the American Diabetes Association.
We hear about the perception that an employer has that in a hypothetical kind of way. But our point is that most people don't experience hypoglycemia or severe hypoglycemia to the extent it would interfere with work at all.
Paul says he's fighting discrimination and perceptions in industries such as transportation or law enforcement, where misunderstandings can turn into a lawsuit. Companies are allowed to evaluate if a worker can do a job safely, but that assessment is supposed to come after someone is offered a position. Paul says too often, employers find out someone has diabetes, then assume there's going to be a problem.
When in fact, there isn't a problem.
A few cases end up in court, but Paul says most disputes over reasonable accommodations get settled with a few phone calls and negotiation.
Tanya English, sounds like a difficult issue to navigate for both employers and for people who have diabetes. And I'm interested in something your piece mentioned, which is the issue of stigma. What kind of stereotypes do people have about diabetes?
You know, a lot of the jokes that we hear are kind of shame-based. It's this idea that people who have diabetes are to blame, that somehow they brought it on themselves. This clip from the Chelsea Handler sitcom is pretty typical.
Chelsea, I've been thinking about you and your sister. You know, when my mom and dad would fight, my dad and I would bake cupcakes for her.
Did that help?
No, she became a diabetic and ran off with her doctor. No, it's okay. He's a really good doctor. He caught it early, so she still has both her feet.
Yeah, not so funny. So obesity is definitely one of the drivers of one kind of diabetes called type 2. But family history, ethnicity, and race also play a role. Mike and I met this man from Delaware County. His name is Randy Childress, and he has type 1 diabetes. And that means his body produces almost none of the insulin that it needs to balance out glucose or sugar. Childress had a job selling cars, and at work, he faced a lot of ignorance about the fact that he needs to check his blood sugar several times a day. Here's his story.
It happened several times that I just wanted to check my sugar before the next people came in and I had to take an automobile out on the road. I would have a sales manager say, I have to see you right now. And I go, just one second. I have to see you now. I would say, just wait 1 minute. It was one more reason for them to say, you know, what is this with this blood sugar thing? You take a test strip out. And you insert it in the glucometer. Okay. Put this in. You puncture your finger. This is the thing that sticks you. You put the blood on the test strip. The glucometer reads the blood sugar. You can go into shock if you're not aware that your blood sugar is dropping. It's crucial stuff. Oh, geez, 30-some years. I've been a diabetic. How do I say this? It's a pain. It really is a pain. It's a profound change in your lifestyle. I started a new job in an automotive dealership. At that particular time, exactly, I was being trained on the new pump. The managers, the rest of them said, well, pump boy, you've got a sales training here that you need to come to. They said, come to training here at the dealership when you're told, or you lose your job. I've got peanut butter and cheese crackers, peanut butter oatmeal cookie. I packed my snacks so that I would be assured that my sugar would be stable and under control. That's the way I dealt with it discreetly. It was said to me on several occasions that, didn't you have your lunch break? Didn't you eat lunch earlier? And you just can't keep saying, listen, I'm a diabetic. I've got to eat this food. Even when I'd have some success and I'd, you know, sell a car, or I'd have somebody close on a car, I would be congratulated by way to go, pump boy. In a car dealership, there really is no HR. My employment ended the end of January where they called me in and they said that I had failed to understand how to sell. And that they were letting me go. It's impossible to say that they let me go because of my diabetes, because any job, anywhere, can find some other way to rationalize somebody being laid off. They didn't understand it, and I really wasn't there to educate them as to what diabetes is all about.
Randy Childress of Delaware County, who has type 1 diabetes, and we have lots more info and pictures from Tanya's story on diabetes in the workplace at whyy.org/thepulse. People with diabetes could have a new resource or helper in controlling their disease, dogs. Dogs like Britannia, who made her radio debut on Fresh Air with Terry Gross in 2012.
I'm rewarding her for various behavior. Right now, I just asked her to focus, which is to look at me. I've asked her several times to sit or down in the chair just to kind of break things up.
Oops, she just fell off the chair. She wasn't paying attention.
She was not. Puppies are very clumsy.
Well, Britannia is no longer clumsy and also no longer a puppy. Since that appearance on Fresh Air, she has continued her training at the Penn Vet Working Dog Center in Philadelphia, and she's about to graduate as the center's first diabetic alert dog. Reporter Larry Roebling shadowed Britannia and the person she'll be helping, Wayne Morey, on a recent training trip through the city.
Let her know she's working and doing something.
Place.
So place is between the legs.
Between the legs,
good
yes.
Job, and the point of that is?
Just to keep her closer to Wayne. It's a good position for while he's doing something, while he's at a register, at a counter. And also once she gets used to it and once she builds a strong bond with Wayne, it's a safe place, so she feels comfortable there if anything scary is happening. It's also a great way to get her nose near where she might smell a change in blood glucose.
I'm on Locust Walk on Penn campus with Working Dog Center interns Marissa Quinlan and Sarah Winter. This is one of many training sessions Wayne Morey is having with his soon-to-be diabetic alert dog, Britannia. Morey, who lives in North Jersey, has been a type 1 diabetic for 50 years. Britannia has been learning to identify and signal when Morey's blood sugar drops below 70. An early alert can give him time to eat something and get his blood sugar back to a safer level.
Check. Check. So what you were looking for was her pawing him?
Her paws
yeah,
up. Yeah.
Yeah. And she will not paw unless...
She won't do that if the scent isn't there.
If it's not left.
Recently divorced, Mowry notes that Britannia's work is important during the day, but even more so during the night, when without someone around, he would be unaware of his condition and perhaps become comatose. Britannia is in training, but Morey is also a student on these walks. He's learning how to communicate with Britannia and meet her needs as well.
Yeah, this is important too, since you know, not only that she had to stop and go to the bathroom, but that was just a really hard stretch of road, so she gets a mental break to kind of relax as well.
The Working Dog Center combines training with research, all with the goal to give working dogs the support they need to do their task and lead healthy, happy lives. Jonathan Ball is a dog handler at the center and is very involved in the Diabetic Alert Program.
So on the research side of things, we are examining what it is that these dogs are detecting. Because right now, we don't know. We know that there's something that's associated with low blood sugar. So part of our research is to identify what that factor is. There are three parts to the training. There is the scent training. That means the training on the body, recognizing that that odor is emitted from the body, then indicating when they find that odor. And then there's the public access piece, and that's training the dog to be a service dog, to be an appropriate member of public society. So that means going into coffee shops or restaurants and being appropriate, lying under the table, not disrupting the regular course of business.
Britannia will officially graduate as a diabetic alert dog sometime this summer. She and Mowry will become a team for life, taking care of each other and enjoying each other's company.
I've been riding motorcycles for probably 30, 40 years of my life, on and off. I might have to get a sidecar.
For now, after her training session, Jonathan Ball and Britannia's four-legged friends greet her back at the center. She heads into her crate for a nap and maybe some kibble.
Take off her leash. All right, Curly, we'll see you in a bit.
For The Pulse, I'm Larry Roebling.
According to the Working Dog Center, it costs about $20,000 to purchase a diabetic alert dog. And, of course, we have photos of Britannia on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Now, ponder this for a moment. What gives us the right to train and sell dogs, to put them to work, or even to have them as pets? A movement is underway that could fundamentally change our relationship with animals and their status in our society. We asked James Serpel, professor of animal ethics and welfare at Penn School of Veterinary Medicine, to explain what's happening, and he started with the current legal status of animals.
Well, the current legal status of animals is that they are things, and the law kind of divides the world into persons on the one hand and things. Persons are essentially human beings, and they have all kinds of legal rights and responsibilities, and then everything else is treated as a thing. A thing may be protected under law if it's property, so if it belongs to somebody and you damage it, that person has the right to sort of claim back the value of the property. But beyond that, it doesn't have much intrinsic value, and so the law doesn't really protect it very well. It's a mess, really. From the perspective of animals, their legal status is very unclear and indeterminate.
There is a push for something called non-human personhood that would elevate the status of animals. I've seen this topic being brought up for years. Lately, it seems like it has resurfaced in conversation.
Yes. Recently, particularly somebody called Stephen Wise, who is a Harvard law professor, has been out and about pushing for this concept of non-human personhood. And he's been out specifically campaigning actually on behalf of individual animals. And in one particular case, it was a chimpanzee called Tommy who was living in New England in somebody's basement. In terrible conditions, supposedly. And the argument here was that this is no way to treat a highly intelligent, cognitively sophisticated animal that is our closest living relative. This is, you know, treating it simply like this person's property that they can keep in a basement in a cage is not appropriate. And I think most people, you know, intuitively sense that that argument has some cogency. It's a sensible argument at some level. But at the same time, when you start to think about the implications of giving animals personhood or non-human personhood, it does appear to open a kind of legal can of worms that could have very, very complicated and drastic ramifications throughout society. So it would obviously affect, for example, the use of animals for farming, food production. It would affect the use of animals for research. It would affect or limit or restrict the rights of pet owners to in terms of what they could do to their pets or do with their pets. So, you know, the ramifications are huge.
What are some of the guidelines that currently govern research that involves animals?
Well, the guidelines for doing research on animals are pretty strict, much more strict, for example, than what we can do to farm animals, food animals. For the most part, anything that's a normal part of farming practice is considered okay, even if it's painful or distressing for the animals. But research animals have fairly robust and heavy-duty protections on them. Many people would say it's still not enough, that they need more, or that we shouldn't use them at all. My argument in that situation is always to say, well, that's fine, but wait till your child has a disease that rests on the use of a drug that was developed using animal models. And I think most people in that situation, understandably, will say, yes, give my child the drug. Even though in their hearts they feel that animals shouldn't be used for these purposes. So we're very torn over these issues.
And do you think a law or creating personhood for animals would have a big impact, or is it ultimately up to us as humans to treat animals well?
I think you're right. It's up to us. It's up to us where we draw the line, and it's up to us to determine how many rights we give them.
But you see humans clearly above animals, obviously.
Not above animals, but I see us as being a separate species. No matter which way you look at it, humans are always going to assert their own rights because we're that kind of animal. And if we assert our own rights, and when those rights conflict with those of other species, we're going to resist anything that impinges on our rights. I don't think we have any inherent superiority over other animals. We're all, you know, as it were, passengers on the same boat. At the same time, I don't blame people for asserting their rights, because it affects their livelihood, it affects their well-being, you know, it affects many, many things. And, you know, we're all individuals. We all want a reasonable life.
But when you said earlier, when it comes down to a drug that was developed, that seems to suggest a hierarchy, that the life of a human obviously is worth more than that of a hamster.
Right. But were you able to ask the hamster? The hamster might say the same thing, that the rights of a hamster are more important than the rights of a human being, because, you know, each species presumably wants to live its life. And has a desire to be not messed with, you know, not maltreated.
But given that you don't see the clear hierarchy, how do you do what you do?
Well, it's not a big problem for me, in the sense that I try and avoid doing things that cause suffering to animals. That's, you know, it's a simple rule.
Right. Do you eat meat?
I do, although I buy free range.
Why?
Because it concerns me the way some animals are kept in agriculture. So I know enough about animal welfare to know that the welfare of some of these animals is very poor. And so I like to, if I'm going to eat meat, I want it to be from an animal that's at least had a decent quality of life.
But you don't have an ethical problem with, again, we didn't ask the cow, but we still eat it.
Mm-hmm. It's a problem. But I'm prepared to accept it. You know, I take responsibility for it.
James Serple is a professor of animal ethics and welfare at Penn School of Veterinary Medicine. Coming up on The Pulse, a drug overdose and close call.
I rolled up on the guy that was overdosed. He was not breathing. His lips were blue. His fingertips were blue. He was sweating profusely.
There is an antidote that can bring people back from the brink of death. How does it work? Find out on The Pulse. You're listening to WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Overdose deaths from heroin have been rising all over the country, in gritty city neighborhoods and leafy suburbs alike. Police officers are pushing to get a tool that could help them save lives. Elizabeth Fiedler reports on the drug some cops are now carrying along with their gun and handcuffs.
A few months ago, Denise Isaacson walked out of her house in a quiet suburban Pennsylvania neighborhood and found her 21-year-old daughter in the driveway.
It was traumatic seeing my daughter laying on the ground, unresponsive. I think my heart stopped beating.
Isaacson lives in Bensalem, on a street where American flags fly in front of homes and the sound of birds chirping is the only noise. It is peaceful and calm. That sense of safety was broken on the night Isaacson's daughter injected heroin for the first time.
I literally was like on top of her, pounding on her, trying to get her to talk to me. I was screaming her name. I was just screaming in hysterics to Sue. I don't even remember think I was saying, oh my God, what do I do? What do I do? I was just screaming.
Isaacson waited for help to arrive. The police got there. Still, she waited, hoping someone would bring her daughter back to her. Finally, Isaacson says, after what felt like hours, the paramedics arrived and gave her daughter the anti-opiate drug, naloxone. The drug is perhaps better known by the brand name Narcan, and it can be injected via syringe or nasal spray. In those dark moments when a person is overdosed on heroin or other opiates, Narcan can bring them back to life. Isaacson's daughter survived and is getting treatment. Lower Makefield Township Police Chief Kenneth Caluzzi knows things could have turned out much worse.
We had somewhere in the area of 60 overdoses in Bucks County alone since the beginning of the year, with about six deaths. So you could see one death's too many. So you could see that the numbers are high, and I don't expect them to go down anytime soon.
Chief Caluzzi says for his cops, arriving on the scene of an overdose can be frustrating. They're not allowed to carry the life-saving drug. They have to wait for paramedics to arrive and administer it.
And that could seem forever for a police officer who's standing there, especially when family's looking on and, you know, demanding that the officer do something to help, and he's just helpless.
Just across the river in New Jersey, police aren't so helpless. In June, the Garden State expanded a pilot program, putting Narcan in the hands of police. Officers in Camden have been quick to put the anti-opiate to use. It was a May morning around 9 o'clock, and Officer Edwin Cortez, a rookie cop, was on patrol.
It's probably about here I heard the screaming, but I didn't know where it was coming from. And about right here is where I stopped my car.
Cortez pulled up to 6th and Cherry Streets in Camden, and a man started hobbling toward him.
He was having a hard, I'm having a hard time breathing, I feel like I'm dying.
The man had used heroin. The rookie cop grabbed a dose of Narcan from his car and administered the drug via a nasal spray. Cortez was the first Camden police officer to save a life by administering Narcan. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie supports the use of the drug.
Treatment is impossible for someone who's died. Simple statement, but true.
New Jersey isn't alone, says the Network for Public Health Law's Deputy Director, Corey Davis.
Law enforcement officers currently carry naloxone in at least 15 states, including Ohio, New Jersey, California, Massachusetts, North Carolina, Georgia, and New York.
There is opposition. Critics wonder if easier access to Narcan will embolden users not to fear ODing. Davis says there's no proof that happens.
I know of no evidence that equipping officers with naloxone increases or decreases drug use, but there is evidence that naloxone access reduces overdose deaths, and one study showed that a naloxone training program reduced drug use among heroin users.
Rich Roberts with the International Union of Police Associations worries whether officers will receive sufficient training to recognize an overdose and on how to administer the drug. Lower Makefield Township Police Chief Kenneth Caluzzi understands the concern, but he wants his officers to have the life-saving drug on hand.
I think it's something new, and it's scary to people, and you don't want to do any harm. But it's relatively simple, and we've had demonstrations on Narcan, and most of the officers know about it now, and know, especially the nasal form, is very, very easy to administer, very safe.
Since late May, Camden police have saved more than a dozen people who are overdosing by administering Narcan. For The Pulse, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler.
So this is one powerful drug or antidote we're talking about here, and it has immediate effects. How does it work? Alana Gordon explains.
This is Narcan, two doses of Narcan that I carry in my patrol vehicle.
The drug is called naloxone, and it is technically referred to as an opioid antagonist.
That is Tom Ferraro.
I'm a professor of biomedical sciences at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University.
In Camden. And
Officer Maureen Bainey from the Camden County Police Department.
She works patrol, 3rd District.
It's an orange box inside. It looks more like a syringe.
So it blocks the ability of opioids to do what they do at the molecular level.
Ferraro says, think of the receptors in your brain as having locks on them. Think of opioids as very special keys. When they get in your system, they seek out those locks on the receptors.
So normally the morphine or the heroin latches on and it's able to unlock the lock.
And it opens and closes that lock again and again.
And then that triggers a cascade of biochemistry inside that particular cell.
This is the basic mechanism of being high. The heroin repeatedly unlocks the lock, releasing from that cell euphoria, happiness, pain relief. But it also tells your body to slow down. Take too much of an opioid? Those keys flood the locks in your brain, and so your breathing and heart rate,
they slow down too slow.
And there you have an overdose.
His lips were blue, his fingertips were blue, he was sweating profusely.
Enter Narcan. Think of it as a key scientists cut to specially fit those locks that heroin likes. But when it gets in those locks, it acts differently.
It's able to, just like morphine, bind, but it doesn't unlock. So it attaches, but it's not able to trigger the cascade of effects inside the cell.
It just sits there, blocking the opioid's access to the lock.
And so you outcompete the morphine.
It all happens very, very quickly.
It's like a countdown.
Almost instantaneously.
The ones that I witnessed, less than 30 seconds it works.
And so if the Narcan's administered soon enough, that slow heart rate, even unconsciousness,
the effects are reversed.
Reversed.
Literally, he's like, watch, it's going to be like a mummy. And they were dead, weren't breathing. They administered and they sat straight up and asked where they were.
It's phenomenal. It truly is an antidote.
Doctors do worry about two things. A really potent dose of heroin could outlast Narcan, and the overdose could come back. More immediately, when Narcan reverses that overdose, it also induces a drug withdrawal. It can be serious, but at the least, really uncomfortable.
At that time, they said, why the F would you do that? You messed up my high, but they weren't even alive when it was happening. So I don't want to say I was excited to use it, but at the same time, it was a neat experience to be able to save somebody.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Americans may not be crazy about the World Cup and soccer, but they certainly seem to fall in love with American goalie Tim Howard.
Now Hazard! Again, Tim Howard, who is having one of the games of even his distinguished career.
Howard's stellar performance has also brought attention to a condition that he's been dealing with since childhood, Tourette's syndrome. It's a neurological disorder that is often the butt of jokes since people falsely think it means swearing a lot. Having Howard as somewhat of a Tourette's syndrome ambassador has given hope to people who deal with this difficult issue and whose lives are very much impacted by it. In this week's edition of Patient Files, let's hear from one such young man and his parents.
I'm Adam Fishbein. I'm 16. I'm a Tourette Syndrome Youth Ambassador.
I am Rachel Ezekiel Fishbein. I'm Adam's mom.
I'm Joel Fishbein. I'm Adam's dad.
I don't remember as much about in the earlier days.
A preschool teacher said, we think there's a problem. Get Adam tested.
I remember I would go under the desk and bark like a dog.
Getting a call. You know, Adam is under the table.
More sensitive to stimuli.
Adam made it really clear that he didn't want to behave this way. I remember him telling me, you know, I would do anything not to act this way. I would take medicine, Mom. I would do anything. I don't want to be this way. Why can't I be in control?
We saw, like, so many different doctors, like, 10, like, more than 10.
We had all these folders and we had this alphabet soup. People said, you know, NLVD, non-learning verbal disability, ADD, OCD, PDD, and he had TS. I was stunned when they said it was Tourette's, because it wasn't what we had thought Tourette's was. He wasn't cursing. He wasn't twitching. It so much of it was just behavior, was...
Well, when we got the diagnosis of Tourette syndrome, we recognized that many of Adam's behaviors that were so disruptive and off-putting were actually tics.
I'm very lucky that I have more mild tics, because if I can suppress them sometimes, but then it comes on a lot worse later. I make loud sounds, and I have this thing called echolalia, which is a tic where I repeat what other people say, and you might be able to get how that could come across as just trying to be annoying. I get emotional sometimes when I have tic attacks, which are when I can't, I have a whole sequence of tics that I cannot stop, no matter what. It's a whole sequence. It can go on for 5 or 10 minutes. And I get emotional sometimes when that happens. I mean, you can probably imagine. It's hard. So I was at school, and I was in the dorm. I've really been trying to make it out of the dorm, suppress it until I can be in a place that is not disruptive to others, because it was 10 o'clock at night, and we have an indoor gymnasium, and I just walked around, did laps while I had a tic attack while I did those loud sounds, and then I went back to the dorm and I went to sleep.
When he is experiencing that kind of a tic attack, he also has these very strong contortions in his face that hurt. You can see it's clear that it's not only loud and disruptive, but also painful for him.
Like my parents, I'm an extrovert.
Watching Adam succeed at all of the things that he's doing, he's been incredibly involved in the community. I don't really worry whether he'll be a successful adult, because while there will be setbacks, and there will be setbacks, he can succeed, and he has succeeded.
A lot of people do not like to talk about it and try to hide it. So I see it as not my responsibility, but I see it as the right thing to do, if you are capable and comfortable, to become a Tourette's ambassador so that you can... You have a voice. You can speak for those people that cannot or will not speak for themselves.
Adam Fishbein is 16 years old, and he is a Tourette syndrome ambassador. And he was talking with his parents, Rachel Ezekiel Fishbein and Joel Fishbein. Coming up on The Pulse, could burned biotrash be magical for your soil and the environment?
It naturally increases the soil's ability to hold water and nutrients, and it also lasts for centuries. So it's a form of carbon sequestration.
Still to come on The Pulse, here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. A Pennsylvania company is in the running for one of the biggest environmental prizes ever, with $25 million at stake. It's called the Virgin Earth Challenge. British mega entrepreneur Richard Branson and Al Gore are looking for novel ideas for greenhouse gas removal, activities that can take more greenhouse gases out of the air than they emit. The product that has caught the attention of the judges in this high-stakes competition is light as a feather. It's called biochar, but it's not for your grill. Here to explain the concept are Jeff Wallen, who heads the biochar company, and biochar Bob Serino, who is an ambassador for the product. Bob and Jeff, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
I think we have to start with a definition. What is biochar? Bob?
Biochar is biological charcoal. It's essentially this kind of charcoal that's intentionally made to be used in the soil. It naturally increases the soil's ability to hold water and nutrients, and it also lasts for centuries. So it's a form of carbon sequestration.
And what is it made of?
Anything organic, from corn stalks to even chicken dung to sticks.
Yeah, almost exclusively wood. The wood products industry takes round trees and turns them into square products, and that leaves a lot of leftover material that often just gets burned in open pits or taken to the dump or just goes to waste. So we can work with a lot of those materials inexpensively and convert them into higher value products.
And Mike, and when I was in Haiti visiting Carbon Roots International, this tremendously successful biochar effort out there, what they're doing is they're taking sugarcane, which is, you know, like a 10-foot grass. All that you do for sugarcane is you press the liquid out and you're left with all this biomass, this fibrous grass. And what they do with that is they just burn it open in a field or just let it decompose. But what they're doing is they're putting it into 50, once it's all dried out, put it in a 55-gallon barrel, and now the farmers can create their own fertility by creating their own biochar from a waste stream.
And Bob, when you put biochar into the soil, what does it do?
It does three things mainly. The first thing is it will last for a very long time. So all the benefits that I'm going to say after this are going to continue for that entire time. The two functionalities, main ones that it has in the soil, is one, the ability to hold water for longer periods of time. So if you imagine all those tiny pores within this charcoal bit holding water, then it increases the natural ability to hold greater amounts of water for longer periods of time, which is a big deal when it comes to drought stress. The second thing is it grabs onto nutrients. It has a variable surface charge, and so the chemicals that are actually the nutrients in the soil can absorb onto the surface of biochar and not get washed out in rain. So it's going to hold the water and nutrients in the root zone for longer periods of time in a completely natural way.
Where do you see the biggest need, the biggest uses for this product?
Well, agriculture is an absolutely huge, huge market for this because, I mean, if you look out to the droughts that we've been experiencing, not only in the U.S. but also worldwide, water availability is definitely something that's on everybody's mind. So putting biochar in the soil naturally increases the soil's ability to hold water longer. So that's a huge implication just on that. Not to mention that we have dead zones based on, all over the world because fertilizers and cow manure and livestock manure is washing into our oceans. Biochar will actually hold onto those nutrients and keep them in place rather than letting them run out. So the water and the nutrients in agriculture are definitely a huge, huge application.
How does the biochar sequester the carbon? Can you explain that?
A plant will take carbon out of the atmosphere in carbon dioxide and use photosynthesis to turn it into its tissues, so its branches or what have you. Then what we do is we take that branch and we put it into, you know, a unit that will make biochar. And instead of having that carbon burn into smoke, it stays as charcoal. So we're essentially taking it out of the atmosphere, incorporating it into a plant, and then fixing that plant in that carbon form for centuries, essentially sequestering the carbon in the soil.
But you do need a lot of heat to make biochar. So where does that heat come from, and how does that not become an environmental problem then?
That's a great question. That was my first question in all of this when we first started. Well, it turns out that a tree is about 50% gas. So when you see forest fires, you know, happen real quick, it's because trees are full of gas and oils. So part of it's carbon, part of it's gas, part of it's oil. Well, when you put it into that environment, what they call producer gas, that the wood brings its own fuel. And, you know, clean technology is the difference between doing it in an open pit or, you know, in some fashion where you're just putting all that smoke up into the atmosphere. You're doing it in a contained environment where you're using those BTUs for their heat values to dry or to run the unit, and then you're sequestering the carbon into the biochar state.
Your company is in the running for a very big prize. Talk about that and describe that challenge.
Okay, yeah. At the time, it was the largest science prize ever offered, $25 million for a business to show that they could sequester carbon on a gigaton scale, which is a massive scale. So if anybody could create a model that could scale up over decades to get to where every year they're sequestering a gigaton of carbon, that would be a big deal. So Richard Branson and Al Gore, you know, and their crazy ideas out on Nectar Island one night probably came up with this idea, and it turned into something that they ended up having over 10,000 submissions from companies with ideas on how to do this. And they brought that down over a few years to 11 companies. One of the companies was one that we merged with. And when you combined all of our assets together, we had a very scalable, workable model to actually go out and start sequestering carbon, which we do on a daily basis now. So, you know, we have a shot. And at the same time, it's a big, hairy, audacious goal. So it's fun. It's exciting to wake up every morning and just kind of have that out in front of you, something to work for.
When will that be decided?
Who knows? I would love to get the call right now, but I think it's going to take quite a while for the scale to really get to a place where they see the major impact.
If I put this into my garden now, how long – do you have any research on how long – how much more water would my garden hold? How long do I not have to water? Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, I think you know this number better than I do.
Yeah. So you'd see an immediate impact. Most people find that they have to water about a third less in a garden situation. And that's a huge impact, a third less water. It just means that water's being retained in the root zone and the plants have more availability to what was laid down before, and you don't have to come back and do it again. 1 cubic foot of our raw product can hold almost 12 gallons of water in it.
Bob and Jeff, thank you so much for stopping by.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Micah.
Yeah, thanks, Micah.
Jeff Wallen is the founder and CEO of the Biochar Company, which is based in Berwyn, Pennsylvania. And Biochar Bob, or Bob Serino, is an educator and biochar ambassador. Chances are that at some point you've walked, run, or pedaled for a cause. Each year there are thousands of walkathons and bikeathons for diseases such as AIDS, cancer, and diabetes that raise both money and public awareness. This year, Penn Center for Orphan Disease Research and Therapy organized the Million Dollar Bike Ride. You may not have heard of the diseases they hope to cure, but the riders involved are determined to change that. Here's an audio postcard from that event.
My name is Lee Sweeney. I'm head of the Penn Center for Orphan Disease Research and Therapy. Today we're having a bike ride to raise awareness and money to sponsor research in some of the rare diseases. By definition, an orphan disease affects less than 200,000 patients in the U.S., but many of them are literally a handful of patients in this country.
All right. We're going to get started with the staging.
My name is Brian Capole. I'm racing for my sons, Andrew and David. And actually, Andrew is riding as well. That's why we got the special bike for him. We're riding for Team NPC. NPC, Niemann-Pick C, which is a rare disease, which is going on with my son as their brain is deteriorating. And it's very rare. There's only like maybe 500 cases known throughout the world.
There's people coming from Washington today to ride in the race. There's a team from Delaware. There's a team from Rhode Island. And we're from Philadelphia. There's eight of us riding for this team. Pedal to Persevere is our name.
We'll start with the longer ride, 70-mile ride.
I'm Patricia Ortiz, and I'm supporting the Million Dollar Bike Ride as a team captain for the LAM Foundation Easy Breathers team. I was diagnosed with LAM in the beginning of 2012. I found out about my disease just on accident. I had chest pains and couldn't breathe, all these lung collapses I had, and they were misdiagnosed for many years because from the outside I look very healthy, I'm in a good shape. No one would ever know that I have something that's wrong with me.
So what we're going to do is we're going to let you go on your
ride. I'm Patty Lynn Fitzgerald, my son David Fitzgerald, Connor Fitzgerald, he's 8, he has Pitt Hopkins, and Kylie Fitzgerald, she's 6. So Pitt Hopkins is a neurodevelopmental disorder that affects mobility and speech, cognitive development. None of the children speak. They do have receptive language, but there is little to no expressive language. That's probably the most difficult thing, to not know when your child is hurt or in pain, or just to hear them say they love you. So some kids aren't walking yet, but we're hopeful that all of them will walk eventually, and that, of course, we want everyone to learn to talk. Connor was the first child with Pitt-Hopkins diagnosed at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And we searched for an answer for about 3.5 years, and he was, it took a long time and a lot of blood work and many tests, and as he was being tested, new research was coming out and they were able to test more genes. And we're so hopeful and grateful with this race that Penn will either conduct their own research or send out, get some grants out there for some other scientists that will help us make new discoveries.
This is going to be the first of many exciting events.
Have a great time. Be safe. Thank you for coming out.
More than 500 cyclists helped to raise $1.4 million that will fund rare disease research. And the organizers plan to make this an annual event. Jeanette Woods produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer and Adam Staniszewski are the engineers. Joel Patterson is our associate producer. Megan Pinto is the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Send us an email with questions, with ideas, with feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.